Welcome to Crosstides, where stories, ideas, and perspectives flow beyond borders. Each episode, we engage in conversations with people from different backgrounds, exploring diverse topics and the experiences that shape us. Whether you're here to learn, challenge your views, or simply enjoy meaningful discussions, you're in the right place. So, let's ride the tides of thought and see where the current takes us. This is Crosstides. Let's begin.
Hey there, everybody, and welcome to another episode of your podcast, Crosstides, where we have conversations that go beyond borders. And today on this episode, I have a special guest with me. And while we are going to talk a little bit about a little bit of everything, as I like to say, this is the first episode that we're recording where we're in the same place as our guest. So I had to bring him all the way from the north of the continent to be our guest here on the program today. And while we are here, we're going to talk. We're also savoring some nice traditional rosquillas from Nicaragua. So this is no one else but my friend, John Paul Rojas, who is joining us today as a special guest on this year podcast, Crosstides. John Paul, how are you doing?
I'm doing good. How are you doing, Sharon?
I'm doing great, especially because, you know, of what we're eating here while we're going to talk also. And also because we have you here on the show today, because I know that this is going to be a very enriching conversation. And I know our listeners are also going to learn a little bit more about yourself and the work that you're doing. So before we get into the real thing, tell us a little bit about who is John Paul. Where is John Paul from? What does John Paul do?
All right, great question. Sometimes I ask myself that. No, but in all seriousness, my name is John Paul Rojas, as you said. I'm from Miami, Florida. That's where I was born and raised. I'm of Nicaraguan and Colombian descent. So I'm proudly, you know, I'm Nicaraguan Colombian American, bilingual English Spanish speaker. And as I spent most of my life in Miami, I also had opportunities to study in other places, such as in Pennsylvania. I'm currently studying at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, and I've also studied in the past in Ecuador. So I like to think of myself also as like a traveling learner, I guess. And so I'm always someone who's on the move. Very hard, you're going to find me staying in one place for very long. And so that's just a little glimpse of who I am. Otherwise, I really enjoy things such as music, history, culture. So it kind of goes aligned with my tendency to travel and see the world.
And your mix of heritage that you mentioned is somebody that knows you, I can honestly say it's quite evident, especially the Latino beat. And I know also that you work in archaeology. Mm-hmm. And it's something that I find quite interesting because it goes hand in hand with anthropology and other social sciences as well. And as those are have been listening to this podcast in the last episodes that we have had, like everybody that we have had here has spoken a little bit about their field, which is related to indigenous people, others to education with in Africa, for instance. So we have had people here that has talked a little bit about their experiences, especially related in this area. And for me, I'm glad to have you here on the show today because I know that you work, you're an archaeologist, and you work specifically on topics related to indigenous societies or native societies, as we also call them here in the Americas. And I would like to ask you, somebody as young as you, why did you decide to take this career path? Why are you are doing archaeology? Why did you study anthropology, if I'm not mistaken? That's your undergrad, your bachelor's degree. Maybe you can share with us a little bit about this.
Yeah. So from the start, I had no idea what anthropology was for most of my life. I was familiar with archaeology, but I was only familiar with the culture, the popular culture side of it. So Indiana Jones, maybe the cool Tomb Raider video games, things like that. But I actually had no idea what it really was. And when I entered undergraduate, I went to a small liberal arts school in a smaller city, almost rural area in Pennsylvania, because I got an opportunity, living in Miami, to go to a different state to study. And when I started there, I started a career in computer science. I had a plan of becoming a tech bro, doing computer science, maybe moving to California, making video games, or maybe even go to Japan and be a video game designer, make money and do what I enjoy because I grew up really enjoying video games and especially adventure-based video games. So I think that's kind of where you can see the seed in archaeology kind of come in later. But after doing it for about a year and a half, I realized it wasn't necessarily what brought me passion. And, for context, this also happened right before the COVID pandemic. So I think once COVID hit and once I've got a little bit deeper into the career, I realized and I had the opportunity to reflect and ask myself, is this what I want to do? Do I want to spend my life, primarily working on these codes, working on these mathematic formulas, sitting behind a computer, which is a great job, but is that something that me, being a whimsical, I guess, traveling-minded person would want to do? And so since I went to liberal arts school, I thankfully had, I guess, a relatively easy time taking classes outside of my career path, which was computer science at the time. And so I started taking other courses, such as I remember there's one course actually that first introduced me to anthropology called midwifery. Like it was just about like midwives and the process of like, how different countries and cultures historically, anthropologically, ethnographically, all those things deal with childbirth and caring for mothers. So it was a very random course, but that's where I started getting introduced to anthropology and I learned the definition, which, there's a lot of ways you can define it, but very broadly, it's a study of humans, it's a study of us. And so within at least the United States system of education and anthropology, it encompasses four major fields, being cultural anthropology, which is, I think, what most people are familiar with, which is, maybe going and interviewing people, making documentaries, things like that. You have linguistic anthropology, which is a very human-based linguistic kind of research. Biological anthropology, which encompasses all sorts of biologically related research on humans from contemporary biomedical anthropology to perhaps bioarchaeology and study of past humans, DNA testing and everything in between. And then you have archaeology, which is generally the study or the anthropology of the human past. And it's many people even define that as recent as the archaeology of yesterday. So it's basically understanding us and interviewing us of the past in a way, but primarily through the objects and the footprints we leave behind as human beings across the globe.
Okay, excellent. And I find it interesting your shift from tech to anthropology. I mean, it's basically two different fields. Social,
Quite literally.
you went from technology science to social science, which I think social science also has its pleasure, if I can put it that way, because you're constantly learning about our societies, the culture, our people in general, and as somebody that also has dedicated most part of their young life to social sciences, I think it's something that is quite interesting. And would you say in a way that your heritage also influence your interest in what you're currently doing? Because as you mentioned at the beginning, your heritage are Colombian and Nicaraguan, and of course you were born and raised in the US. How would you say this influence your interest in what you're currently doing?
So that's a great question. I think it did influence a lot. So as I told you, I started with computer science, and once I took courses in anthropology, I got to see, the opportunity to learn about other topics. I'm gonna be honest, when I was in high school, I did not like history. I did not like social science that much. I enjoyed geography. Admittedly, I loved human geography. I had a great teacher in high school, and I enjoyed things such as language and things like that. But at least in the US education system, I didn't like history, and I think it had a lot to do with what it was being presented as, at least, during my educational experience, which was more of a focus on a European and very United States-based education. And while that has its benefits, I think it didn't really get to expose me to what I identified most with growing up, which is, my own heritage and where I live, because I grew up in the United States, but I also grew up in a very large diaspora community in Miami, which has a significant amount of Latino and especially Latino and Caribbean populations from Cuba, from Venezuela, Colombia, Nicaragua, Haiti, the Bahamas, Trinidad, Tobago. And so growing up in such a diverse, especially, I guess, like American continent melting pot, I guess I didn't really foresee what I was reflecting in my daily life in what I was learning. And so when I finally did take some anthropology courses, including that midwifery course in college, I think it made me realize almost, it seems foolish now, but at the time it was like, okay, so studying the American continent and studying indigenous people and Afro-descendant peoples and our heritage is actually a valid, academic pursuit, which I think is something that wasn't really made clear to me during my high school and my public education experience. So when I saw the opportunity that people were doing work in places, my advisor actually was doing work in Bolivia. I've met people working in Guatemala and Belize, all over the continent, and they're working on indigenous Afro-descendant themes. I was begin to wonder, oh wow, I wonder what kind of work is being done in my countries and where I'm from. So what's being done in Colombia, what's being done in Nicaragua, and there was such amazing things I learned. But I also saw that even within the American continent, there was still a large amount of space for work to be done, especially in regions that aren't seen as like the, I guess, National Geographic aspect of like interesting history, such as the Maya, the Aztecs, the Inca Empire, what tends to like bring the money and the attention because of different factors such as large architecture, maybe better written colonial histories, things like that. And so it kind of almost pushed me to be like, I wonder if I could be that person to be an advocate for those histories as well, and be able to put as much value as, history puts on other types of history, such as US history or maybe the empires of the Americas and other continents as well. And so I think that's where the push started. And I remember starting to write my papers always around different Latin American themes, just to get to explore that realm of social science and explore the geography and all those aspects.
And then how was that seen by your lecturers, your professors, or by your classmates? Because I can imagine maybe that your classroom was quite diverse. Maybe there were people from Latin America, or their parents, their grandparents were from there, or from the Caribbean. But maybe there were also people that have been their family have lived in the U.S. their whole entire life. How was your experience when you shared this topic around these people? Like, what was their reaction?
So going to undergraduate in a smaller part of Pennsylvania was really a different type of cultural exchange and diversity, because it's, you're right, going to like a pretty prestigious university, I got to meet so many people from across the globe, and it was a different type of diversity than what I was used to in Miami, because as I told you, most of Miami was African American or Caribbean or Latin descent. Versus here, where I really had people from all over, people from different parts of the African continent, different parts of Asia, even from Oceania, a lot of people from Europe, international students, people just in America of those descents. And of course, you also have people who've been in the country for decades, whether it's Native Americans or European Americans who have strong roots from colonial times, or different African American communities from across the country. So I think being able to meet those people, you realize there's so much that I don't know and I can learn from them. But then it also made me realize, for a lot of these people, I am one of their few representations of these countries, and I feel like, especially since I was also like born and raised in Miami, in the US, that was like a lot of like responsibility that I was like, okay, so how do I represent this with care and, be a good example of what it means to be of Colombian or Nicaraguan descent and represent those countries when there was not a lot of people there in general representing it. And so it led to a lot of interesting discussions. It made me really take a lot of pride in what I am and what my heritage is, and trying to find ways to communicate that with people that are interesting and produce productive conversations, because I always feel there's so much I can learn from other people as well. And I think that was really important for me to be able to do that at my undergraduate.
Basically, you're creating an impact. And I'm not that familiar with the US education system, but I do know based on my experiences that conversations I have had with friends from other places, other countries, for instance, or even my experiences studying abroad, that you have some universities or even some high school, let's say, that their curriculum tend to have subjects or modules that goes around historical topics. What I'm maybe kind of curious, and I would like to ask you, and probably those that are listening that maybe they don't know also as well, in the US, let's say, for example, based on your experience, would you say that when it comes to talking in the classroom, it doesn't matter if it's a high school or university level, about let's say colonization or even today's world outside of the US border, would you say that it's from a more US-centric perspective or neocolonial perspective, or there's actually some conversations going around that are also decolonial ways.
Yeah, that is a great question. And I mean, I can only speak like very prominently about my own experiences. I feel like I've heard people have different experiences, which is great. You know, I've heard people have really productive conversations in high school versus people who just didn't really question things in high school that were taught to them. In my case, I would say I had both. I would say in high school, I did have amazing teachers and amazing classmates that would bring up these conversations, especially as I said, being in Miami, I did get to see, you know, the living experience of people who are also like me, who are like the children of migrants or migrants themselves, and people with different backgrounds. So we did have fruitful conversations. But I think in general, since you're asking about the system, there wasn't as much, not that there was no space for it, but I don't think it was directly implemented for us to be questioning these kind of things to such a deep level. I think there was a sense of, you know, we're learning about the US history, we're learning about Europe's contributions and things like that. I mean, you could even see that in the courses that are offered. We had AP US history, AP European history, and you even had an AP world history, although I have my critiques on that as well, but just because it wasn't have as much breadth as you would wish, especially because you're learning only like less than a year about the world. That's so much to learn. So it's a natural, you know, issue that's going to come up with that kind of course. But in undergraduate, I would say it was actually quite the opposite. I think because we had small classroom sizes, it was very seminar or conversation based. And because we had professors who were very into us being vocal about our opinions and how we interpret readings, class conversations, documentaries, things like that, it really did lean a lot towards having these conversations of what is the impact of the US education system, what is the impact of the country, of other countries, and more specifically, or more broadly, I guess, topics of colonialism, neocolonialism, and how do we decolonize what we like to call the canon, or what is accepted as, you know, what you learn and what is the norm of our history and our past as a collective, you know, human race.
And did you receive classes about Latin America? Because you mentioned like world history, you mentioned Europe, AP Europe, I think you said. I mean, was there anything about Latin America that you learned?
Oh yeah. So once I got, so that was in high school, those courses that I took, or those courses that were available. In college, we had, of course, such specific courses, which I really appreciated. I remember I took one course on basically Andean like history and cultures and people. So it was an anthropology course, social anthropology oriented. And it was basically reading different ethnographies and narratives by different indigenous and mestizo authors from across the Andes, so across the South American continent, which goes from Chile and Argentina all the way to Colombia, Venezuela, the Andean mountain range, that is. And then I took another course that was about Mesoamerican archaeology. So it really centered on all types of populations, such as the Zapotecs, the Aztecs, the Maya, and the Toltecs, all the people in what you would consider Mesoamerica, which today encompasses central Mexico, southern Mexico, Guatemala, Belize, and parts of El Salvador and Honduras primarily. And so that was a really great opportunity to do that. I also took broader Latin American history courses, which were also more of a, I guess, continental-based education or course. And so I did get to take these courses, and that's where I really got to develop my thoughts and gain a stronger academic handling of these themes and these histories. So it was no longer me just being someone from Miami saying, well, yeah, I mean, I love arepas and repochetas because, you know, that's what I grew up eating. Now I could be like, make some academic contributions to these countries as well, or to the topics about them, not just, you know, the things I grew up with, which was really great as well.
And speaking, I love what you said about the arepas and the rapochetas, which are very delicious, by the way. For those that haven't tried arepas, which can either be from Colombia or Venezuela, we're not gonna get into where it's from, but it's good. And rapochetas as well, which depending on where you are in Central America or Mexico, rapocheta can be something
Yeah, totally
different.
different.
Come try the rapochetas in Nicaragua. But you spoke about academic contribution, and I think that's very important, especially because you know at a young age you're trying to do your part in the field, of course, and trying to expand more studies and the knowledge base on in the field that you're studying, which is archaeology. And I would like for you maybe to talk a little bit about what you're currently doing, because I know that's of course one of the reason why you're here visiting in the country. It wasn't because like I stole you for the podcast not this time, but I know that you have been here in the countries for a few months, and you have been working on a project, and which
I find very interesting. I would like for you maybe to share a little bit about what this project is all about, where is it taking place, and why did you decide to do this project here in Nicaragua?
Okay, so I'll start with how the project kind of came up over the years that led up to it. So as I said, I switched my career undergrad to archaeology, and I got on board with my advisor's project in Bolivia. So I actually did get to make use of my computer science because given COVID, given kind of like, you know, the middle of my college experience shifts to a different major and all the other factors, I ended up making my honors thesis, my undergraduate honors thesis, about different human ecological interactions, especially on the Lake Titicaca Basin between Peru and Bolivia, and use satellite imagery and remote sensing to identify changes over interannual and intra-annual periods and seasons from the 1970s up until the 2021. And so that's where I got to kind of merge those two and make a slow transition into anthropology. Following that experience, I got the opportunity to be involved in an archaeological project for 2 months in coastal Ecuador, specifically in the Department of Santa Elena. And that was also a very great both ethnographic and archaeological project that I really got to experience different sides of fieldwork, from excavating to lab work to interviewing people and asking them about their own heritage and oral histories. And then finally, I also got the opportunity to work at the UNESCO World Heritage Site of Palenque in Chiapas, Mexico, which is one of the most famous, I guess, stereotypical Maya pyramids you think of when you think of archaeology of the Americas, with such a rich and deep history as one of the most prominent urban centers of the American continent. And we got to also collaborate with different indigenous, predominantly Chol Maya communities in the area. And so those were really fruitful experiences and showed me that archaeology can be a very social aspect. I think archaeology tends to be sometimes be like seen as this single adventure type character, such as Indiana Jones, going off into the middle of nowhere with strange people and figuring his way out. But these opportunities were very collaborative. And as I mentioned, I've always had a strong tie and passion for my own heritage. So I wanted to try to merge those aspects of what archaeology can look like from a community perspective with my own heritage and my own background. And so I decided to start looking into Nicaragua, Colombia's options. And as I started getting into the literature, I noticed that, especially in the case of Nicaragua, there is much less work being done than maybe compared to its neighbors in Costa Rica or Honduras. And I also noticed that even within the country, there was a larger focus on the Pacific coast and to a lesser extent, the central part of the country, but much less work being done on the Caribbean coast. And so I think that's where I started begun to wonder, okay, I wonder why so little work has been done. I wonder if people are just not really pushing for, you know, seeing what's beyond, I guess, the really interesting Pacific side, because I think there is a bias towards seeing this beautiful pottery and things that we are encountering in the Pacific coast in Nicaragua and Costa Rica as well in the Nicoya Peninsula. So I began to look into the literature, and by complete coincidence, my grandmother's brother-in-law, he had a really close friend who's a prominent archaeologist in Nicaragua. And so I got connected with him, and he turns out that he had worked as well on the Caribbean coast, including on the Corn Islands. So I began to wonder about the insular part of Central America, because a lot of people who do Caribbean-based archaeology tend to focus on the major islands, the Antilles, and they kind of overlook Central and South America as also being part of the Caribbean, especially the coast of Venezuela, Colombia, Panama, Costa Rica, Nicaragua, Honduras, et cetera, et cetera. And so I really got interested in this conversation of what's going on at the circum-Caribbean level, the greater Caribbean level, and the fact that the Corn Islands had had surveys done and has a rich oral history of the indigenous people and evidence, archaeological evidence that have been published for over 15 years now that there are artifacts, but no one has ever done a follow-up to that, you know, that formal publishing of that work. I realized I think this is a great opportunity to start talking about the Caribbean coast of Central America, the Caribbean coast of Nicaragua, and the role it has in this larger region. And so I contacted this close friend of my uncle, and he was on board. And so we began to start developing what's called the Proyecto Arqueológico del Municipio de Corn Island, or the Corn Island Archaeological Project, and the PAMSI, as we like to call it. And that's when I began looking really deeply into the ethnohistoric literature, the oral history, and the ethnographic literature, because that's what's mostly predominated. That was what mostly was available, and the limited archaeological research that was also done. And I began wondering about, okay, so what is the context? Who were the people who first populated this island? What interactions did they have? How was life in an island context? And so just to give a very brief story, the Corn Islands, from what we understand so far archaeologically from the oral histories and everything that people talk about today, we have the first population was the Cucra people, who originally came from the area that's known as Cucra Hill and Bluefields in Nicaragua's southern Caribbean coast. And so they populated the islands and moved from being just a coastal and riverine-oriented society to a society that now is living seafaring and quite literally going to islands in the middle of the Caribbean. And so from a research standpoint, that's also really interesting to see how humans are so adaptable and so able to build these new geographic connections. And so I began to, last year was my first year being able to do field work. I got to go to Bluefields and go to the museum there and work with some people there. And then eventually got to go to both of the Corn Islands, Great Corn Islands and Little Corn Islands, and begin to work with the Casa Cultura, the culture house over there, and just meet with a bunch of different local community members and ask them what they knew about the land, what they knew about their history, and start bridging that aspect, the indigenous history, to the other histories of Nicaragua and the Corn Islands, such as the Afro-descendants' histories, for example, the Creole people. And so I think that's really how it got started. And now we're currently in our second year of doing it. And so, as you said, you didn't kidnap me. I'm here on my free will. Blink twice, okay? But yeah, so I've been here, and I've been... since last year, we did some surveys of both the islands and were able to collect some archaeological materials and do some brief test pit excavations. We began analyzing that stuff and sharing our results, our preliminary results to the community. So, and when I say evidence, I'm referring to objects such as old ceramic sherds, maybe different figurines, stone tools, very rare occasions, animal bones, which represents what they might have been eating. So we began doing that kind of work and have even brought it now to a different medium as well, where not only are we engaging with the people who are directly on the Corn Islands, but making it accessible through virtual formats, such as where we recently began the Corn Islands Virtual Museum in collaboration with the Corn Islands Virtual Library, which is really exciting. And we got to start sharing that in June. So yeah, that's kind of what I'm working on right now. And this is leading to my doctoral dissertation at Vanderbilt. So that's where we're at.
I mean, I think you're one of the luckiest guy in the world, because your office for most part of the year is on a tropical island in the Caribbean.
Yeah.
Where, and I'm not just saying this because I'm from there, but like where the food is good, people are really nice. And of course, you can sit near the beach and just type on your laptop whenever you have to.
Which I have done.
I've seen your photos and of your work, and of course, of you in enjoying yourself on the islands. And something that really calls my attention is, I think it was one of the recent posts I saw on the Instagram page of the project, is that with the excavation last year, or even this year with the lab work that you and your team has been doing, like there's always people around that are noticing, and I notice specifically kids.
Yeah.
Like, how do you feel to see like kids or adolescents curious? I have seen some of them even helping clean in the mm-hmm. ceramic. Have you and your team been trying to show them a little bit about the process? Have you made much of the time there, not only to excavate but also to educate people and in this aspect younger people as well?
Yeah, so I'm so glad you noticed that. The first year we got there, of course we wanted to engage with the community and make it a very collaborative based project. But I don't think I realized how deeply the children would get involved and be excited about what we were doing. Maybe it was because we weren't from there, so they weren't used to seeing us. Maybe it was because we had funny hats or like funny tools in our hands. They're like, oh, what toys are those? What is that? But I think that children were genuinely very interested in what we were doing. I mean, I've heard a lot of people say, especially children, but even adults talking about their childhood, reflecting on the past, that growing up in the Corn Islands, they would find cool little looking animal toys made of dirt or made of stone. And they wouldn't think much of it at the time, but they thought it was really interesting. And it kind of creates the sense of like, you know, discovery and excitement because you're learning about something you're not familiar with. And so when we got there and started doing, especially our test pit excavations in Great Corn Island, the children would just come after school or come right before school to say hi and just ask what we were doing. And so we would start teaching them, oh, we're digging like this. Why is it a square? Because we're trying to capture a certain area where people might've lived or left things, so we can understand basically where it's coming from, what it is. They'd start collecting little pieces they found when they're playing in the playground or playing around. And they'll bring it to us and ask us, what is this? And we'll tell them, oh, that's a ceramic piece. Or they'll find really cool things. I remember one child even found like a little turtle lizard head made of clay, made of ceramics to be exact. And he was just really excited. And I was like, oh, look at this, look what I found. And so, you know, it was a sense of, it was a kind of a good mix of just like playing, but it wasn't just playing, because we were teaching them and they were learning, and they realized, okay, there's something special about here, because especially what we were doing at the time, most people pass it every day and don't think much of it. And so we really wanted to make sure that they saw the value in it. And I like to think, you know, children are both sponges and also the future. Sponges because they are very quick to learn things, you know. I mean, I really wasn't exposed to archaeology until I'm in university, but these children are quick to grab on what's going on and what's happening. They're like, oh yeah, that's from the past. Oh yeah, that's made of clay from Mount Pleasance, which is on Great Corn Island. And they're just quick, and they'll figure things out. But like, oh, that looks like an animal. That looks like a turtle or a dolphin or a duck. And so they were like, and many times they would be making revelations to me, you know, which is really cool. And then this year, the same thing applied. I mean, we did more lab-based work this year. When I say lab work, I mean, we worked with the museum, the Culture House. But the children from Music Pathways, or just when children are walking by and just came to the Culture House for whatever reason, they'll see what we're doing. And same thing, they'll be wondering, what is that? Why are you guys doing this? Those aren't stones. Or, oh, they'll realize that's clay. Those are ceramic materials. And you know, what's really interesting, they all have different interests of what we're doing for different reasons in the physical level as well. Like some of them just thought it was really cool that we were wetting these weird stones and cleaning them with toothbrushes. I remember one child even just really liked the aspect of like organizing them and saying, I love puzzles. And I wonder if this is something I can do in the future. I can be an archaeologist in the future. And that just made me feel really special because I don't, you know, at least right now in the Cornelians, there's not really an archaeology study in the university or the schools. So I feel like this is probably one of the first, if not the first time, they're really exposed to it. So to hear them saying that this is something that's interesting to them was really exciting. And so, you know, this is obviously the first steps. We want to continue, you know, with the online platforms, but also being able to do more, I guess, engaged work with especially the children, the adolescents, the students of both the islands, so they can really learn about this, whether they're interested in the history aspect, the puzzle aspect of being an archaeologist, the adventure aspect, or just want to have fun and gain something out of it at the same time. Which I think is what's happening. And it felt like a very bonding opportunity because I remember all the kids would give me different nicknames. For last year, for example, some of the girls, they were a little flirtation. They'll call me like Tio Wapo. I was like, you know, very endearing. Or like, you know, Uncle Handsome. But or they'll call me Messy Boy because I had a messy shirt that I would always wear to the field. I'm actually wearing a messy shirt right now. let's go into Miami. But yeah, so they'll call me Messy Boy. And then this year, since my name is Jean-Paul, but when I first told them my name is Jean-Paul, they had never heard of that name. So they called me Chamoy.
Chamoy.
Like the Mexican sauce. So I just started getting called Chamoy by all the kids. I'm like, ah, Chamoy, Chamoy. And you know what? It stuck.
This is actually a good nickname. And I think it's actually something really inspiring that you're doing because... as I said, of course, I've seen the photos of the work that you have been doing along with your team. Mm-hmm. And we have also collaborated on some aspects as well through the Corn Islands Virtual Library and now the Corn Islands Virtual Museum, which mm-hmm. is jointly together with the library and with the project that you're working on right now on the mm-hmm. islands. And I have to honestly say, I also have learned a lot from you and your team. And you're totally right. The islands are really not known for... archaeology or even much for indigenous history, mm-hmm. even though there has been references in the in past diaries and books of pirates and sailors and others during the 1600s, like William Dampier, if I'm not mistaken, mm-hmm. he was Welsh, yeah. where he described the Kukras people or Kukra Indians as we call them. So I think actually it's something quite interesting that you're doing because beyond a research, it will also with the results and what you're doing right now with your team is going to transform also the way us as local look on the islands and also the people from the country in general, because the islands are known for its beautiful beaches, mm-hmm. white sands, turquoise water, and pristine and all of that, mm-hmm. and of course the Afro descendant culture. Mm-hmm. So to give it also an extra layer of history, mm-hmm. or to make it more known to people, I think it's also good. And what your team is doing for me is excellent, and I'm glad also that in some way or another I can collaborate, and I like that the community also is involving themselves as well. Mm-hmm. And if I may ask you, which is a question I like to ask people whenever I talk with them, and I don't remember if I asked this to many of my guests on the podcast, but I do ask mm-hmm. this sometimes to some friends, it's like, who is somebody that inspires you to be you and to do what you're doing? Is there mm-hmm. anybody, I don't know, maybe somebody from television or somebody from
yeah
that you know?
Yeah, so I mean, I don't know if this is like a cheesy or really sweet answer, but it's my genuine answer whenever I think of someone who inspires me. I always think of my grandfather, my maternal grandfather, my mom's dad, who is from Nicaragua, from Riva specifically, and he's no longer with us today, unfortunately. He passed away during COVID, but in his life, he was such a powerful man, but not in the way that people think of powerful as just being strong in a physical sense, but because he had such a big heart, such a caring heart, and was willing to adapt and pretty much engage and have a great relationship with anybody. Because he was a medical doctor actually in Nicaragua, and eventually had the opportunity to also be a doctor in Canada and then Miami, which is where he eventually lives until he passed away with my family. And so seeing how he was so able to adapt, he was able to learn languages. He spoke Italian, Spanish, English. He had friends pretty much from all over the globe, especially the Americas, but even in Europe. He just had like such deep connections. And everyone loved him. And, he was always expressive. He was never someone to like hide his emotions in a way that felt like protective or secretive, but really be open about the human experience in a way. And, even though he was a medical doctor and nothing related to archaeology necessarily, there is still some connection because he was very human. He was very willing to travel and try new things and new cultures and just care about people for who they are and not what they have to offer him. And he always, would put other people first. If they couldn't, pay for his services or anything like that, he wouldn't charge people. He would just, because he, at the end of the day, he just really wanted people to be well and okay and live a good life, which is what he always put in practice as well, because he was very, good at his job and good at everything he did. But he didn't make his life only about being a professional. He also truly just enjoyed life. I remember one time, for one of his birthdays, my mom got him a really fancy bottle of wine because he also really enjoyed wine from Italy. And she kind of assumed that he'd save it for a special occasion. A week later, she asked him like, "Oh, where's the wine?" Because she was looking at his like, I guess in the kitchen, not his wine collection. He's like, "Oh, I drank it." And she's like, "What do you mean you drank it?" He's like, "We don't know what's gonna happen tomorrow, so just enjoy it today." And so, I mean, he had that playful aspect while still being responsible, but I think that's such a good balance that I always latch onto, because I think, it is a, like you were saying, being in the Corner Islands is easy to be caught up in the fun of it, which I do enjoy, the aspect of being there, but also tie that into like making an impact and engaging with other people and whatever you're doing. In my case, archaeology, in his case, being a doctor. And so I think that's where I've learned a lot and gotten a lot of inspiration from. And, I'm right now doing my PhD, obviously, which would mean one day I will be a doctor myself, not a medical doctor, but still have a doctor title. And so I would be the next one to do it after him, which I don't know, also is pretty inspiring.
Well, I guess you already have your checklist of traveling and friends from different parts of the globe
Yeah.
as well. And for you, why would you say it's important to study your past? Because obviously everything that you're doing, it's based on uncovering the past.
Right.
How would, or better said, why would you say that this is relevant? And to let people know as well, like it's important to know about who was here before us and even who maybe we were
Yeah.
before.
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the really cool things about humans, us as humans, is that we are biocultural creatures. We are, obviously animals. We're human, we live, we breathe, we do things that animals do. But at the same time, something that really makes us stand out is this thing that we call culture, which is very difficult to define. I don't pretend to do that here right now, but
That would be for another
yeah, it's a whole other
podcast.
topic. But essentially, that aspect of what is more than us being biological creatures, but what is aspect of connection of what we do, whether it's what we eat or how we speak, what languages we speak, who we engage with, all different types of things. And so that culture does not come from a vacuum, does not come from nowhere. The way we live our life, the food we eat, where we decide to live, where we prefer to live, things like that. There is a personal aspect to it, sure. There's a biological aspect, you have to eat to live, there's some things you have available, but there's also a very strong cultural aspect. And I think archaeology really provides the opportunity to tie that history together and allow us to really understand ourselves today based on our past, whether it's your ancestors or the people who lives in this place before you and things like that, and see how there's really a continuity and a, a continued, I guess, building of off of what we have done in the past as human beings, and be able to learn from that. Because in history, for example, there's a lot of people who say, "Oh, you can't understand yourself now if you don't know your past." And I think archaeology is the same thing. But what I really like about archaeology, and the understanding the past through that lens is that we are no longer limiting ourselves to a primarily written or oral history, which are also very beneficial and have the benefits, no doubt, but allow us to see things from different lenses, especially very material or biological lens, whether you're a bioarchaeologist or just, you know, an archaeologist working with different objects from the past, because they often tell us a different story. Stories such as what happens in daily life, what are people eating every day, what did relationships look like, what did architecture look like, what did hunting or what did like celebrations look like, what were burial practices, how were people treated or treating each other, who were engaging with who, so maybe trade or migration patterns in the past. And it really helps us understand, you know, where we're coming from, especially from like a lens such as like, you know, indigenous or Afro-descendant histories that isn't always well represented in certain types of histories. And so it really allows us to question or to ask those questions from different perspectives and understand the past from different perspectives. You know, there's, I think, a common saying that, oh, the winners write history. But with archaeology, it doesn't necessarily have to be the quote unquote winners per se, but it can be anyone's history that can be understood from this lens and appreciated and celebrated and used as a form of understanding your heritage, your past, and celebrating your present. And I think that can take so many different things at a personal level, maybe at a public level, you know. So I would say that's one of the really major benefits of archaeology as a field and using it to understand our past.
It's like how they say, to know where you're going to go, you need to know where you come from.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. I agree. And so, you know, that's basically what it is.
And what has been one of the, I don't know, the most craziest or spookiest thing you have found during like excavation?
Okay. this one is a little, I don't want to cause any conspiracy theories with this one, but it was weird. So when I was working in Chiapas, Mexico, you know, the Palenque, the Maya site, I was working in urban context. I wasn't working at the, you know, the cool fancy temples, but I was working more on the houses around the major ritualistic and political centers. So it was more everyday architecture, everyday houses. Still very fascinating. But I remember I was digging in what we thought at the time, I'm not quite sure now, but at the time we thought it was a trash pit. And I remember hitting something really hard with my trowel, which is the basically tiny shovel that we use. And I realized, okay, it can either be a stone or something else. So I'm going to be very careful and go around it. And I see white. It's a bone. Okay. But what kind of bone is it? And I start digging it. And it's a very flat bone. And I keep digging and digging and digging. And it just goes on forever. So I start wondering, is it a turtle shell maybe? I don't know. And then I keep digging and digging. And eventually, I'm not a formally trained bioarchaeologist. I don't specialize in study in bones, much less human bones. But it is something that I am familiar to work with. At the basic level. So I continued excavations, you know, with some advice from my bioarchaeologist friends. And eventually we came to realize it was a human skull, but it was a modified human skull, meaning that as part of like maybe the ethnic traditions at the time, they would put two wooden planks on the head, one on the back, one on the forehead, to elongate the head. So the actual forehead was twice the size of a normal forehead, which is why I thought it was a turtle shell at first, because I didn't realize that it was a really, like, you know, physically modified body, like body modification of the head. And then in that exact same context, I kid you not, I found two pieces of meteorite. And this is why I said I don't want conspiracies, because I think there's a tendency for popular media to tell these stories from, like, you know, about aliens. I don't agree with that, because I think it definitely distorts what's actually happening and distorts the accomplishments of indigenous peoples across the globe. With that said, I can see why people would come to those conclusions when they see, you know, larger foreheads and meteorites in the same context at a really impressive site. So I really didn't know what to make of it. And like we really thought, what could this be? Because I'm like, it was just like a really shiny, like almost rainbowish rock, but really smooth, metallic. And, you know, metals weren't really common in the pre-Hispanic Americas. So, and it wasn't shaped like anything. It was just like a blob. It was really interesting.
Okay, that's totally crazy. I mean, I guess History Channel already has another episode that they can do now, you know, as they are always, or recently in the last few years, they have been talking a lot about aliens. So
yeah,
I mean, you have never told me that one before, but I think it's actually, it's really good. And also here on our podcast, we have a segment that is called Cross Tides Spotlight, where we ask our guests to share a random fact about their country, mm-hmm. Or to say something about their country, maybe what other people does not know. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have a big task today because you're represented more than one place. So what would be something maybe you would like to share with our listeners that perhaps they don't know about where you come from?
Oh my gosh, this is the famous part of the podcast I was waiting for. okay, so let's see. As I said, I was born and raised in Miami. So the United States is a really, really big country. I don't think some people, without visiting, I don't think people realize how large it is. I think sometimes you joke around, it's pretty much another continent of itself. And I think there's some truth to that. With that said, there's also some really interesting things to it. One thing that I think a lot of people don't realize, because the United States doesn't have an official language. I think the most common language, as most people know, is English, but it's not an official language. And in fact, if I'm not mistaken, the United States, in terms of actual population, has the fifth largest amount of native Spanish speakers in the globe. So there are more, by number, more native Spanish speakers in the United States than maybe in other countries simply because of population. And that's largely because of migrants or the children of migrants, such as myself. In the case of where in Miami, actually, it has the largest Nicaraguan population in the United States, which is pretty interesting. We even have, I wouldn't think I love about my city is that we have these little communities. We have Little Managua, Little Havana, Little Haiti, and we have other historical places such as Coconut Grove, which is a historically Bahamian community from the Bahamas. And then we have Kenzo, which has a large Colombian population. So I feel like a lot of people, especially when they go to Miami, they think of like, you know, the flashy parts of Brickell, downtown Miami Beach. But I think there's something to be said about the culture aspect. So I think I'm answering all three countries in one by saying that we have such a significant Colombian Nicaraguan diasporas in Miami, which is where I'm from. And you can see that in the everyday. I mean, I was telling you, remember a few months ago now that, you know, we have Centro Comercial Managua. We have Parque Rubén Darío, who's a major poet from Nicaragua. And so I don't know. I think that's just really special. And there's just other really cool facts, such as, like, I think over 60% of the Miami population actually was born abroad. And then I think, what's it called? It also has the largest amount of international banks, I think, like in the Americas, and one of the top ones in the world. So I don't know. It's just a lot of really cool things I like about it being like this kind of, you know, hub of the Americas, so to speak.
And for you, is the arepas Colombian or Venezuelan, or is the gallo pinto Nicaraguan or Costa Rican? You don't have to answer that. We don't want to cause any war.
I'm not going to make any controversial answer, definitive opinion, but I think we can all appreciate our shared pre-Columbian roots in those foods, and that's all I'm going to say.
I like that answer. So it's a first. It's a first, but I like the answer. So Jean-Paul, we're coming to the ending part of this episode. I don't know if maybe if there's something you would like to share with those that are listening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I mean, I really appreciate being here, and I hope maybe if some of you haven't heard of archaeology or maybe of anthropology before, that you've got something out of this. And, you know, I really encourage anyone really to explore more about anthropology, archaeology, maybe even like bioanthropology, linguistics, whatever, to just see like how much, like, I don't know, appreciate us as humans and how much diversity we have and how much we have like history and things we've contributed to the world as, you know, like from where, no matter where you're from, because, you know, it's not just about like, you know, the global superpowers, but also each of us, each of our cultures have contributed such major things to this world and to our livelihoods. And so, you know, I think, I guess one thing I would want people to take away with is, you know, never just like simplify things that, you know, like one is better than the other, or judge a book by its cover, because there's so much complexity. And once you open your mind to appreciating people from different backgrounds, languages, geographies, nations, whatever, you really open your own world and you grow yourself as a person. And I think just, you know, stay open-minded to that and appreciate the world we live in. I always see people are like so excited about space exploration, which is pretty cool, but I feel like there's so much to like quote unquote explore in our own planet that most people have never even thought about or experienced, you know. So, you know, space exploration, but also just understand where we're at right now on Earth as a, you know, a human population. There's so much to see in this world. So yeah, I guess I'll leave it at that.
Thank you very much, Jean-Paul, for being here, and I wish you much success in all your endeavors and everything that you're doing with the project on the Caribbean of Nicaragua, and also with your life in general and everything that you're going to be doing from here onward. And to everyone that were listening, I hope you could take you were able to take something from this episode. And as always, I appreciate those that are always in tune and are always messaging me and letting me know, like, hey, I listened to the last episode, and you know, like, so really appreciate the support also. And just reminding everybody that we are also on Instagram, LinkedIn, and Facebook. You can find us as Cross Tides Podcast, where we are always trying to share the links of our episodes and of our guests, because there will be more guests coming in the following weeks and months as well. So stay tuned. And also remember that we are on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music. We are on all of your streaming platforms. So don't forget to subscribe and leave your comments as well. And of course, if there are some topics that maybe you would like for us to talk about, you can also leave your comments on our social media and also on our streaming platform. And with that being said, this was Sharon Tower here with John Paul, and it will be until next time on your podcast, Cross Tides. Take care. See you next time.